Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you again by our friends from ZipRecruiter, and we are joined by former Republican Congressman David Jolly from Florida. Well, I don't know whether you're in Florida right now. You seem to get around a lot, but welcome back to the podcast, David.
Hey, great to be with you, Charlie.
Well, let's start off by talking about the circus in front of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday. I broke it down into two acts. In Act One, Corey Lewandowski puts on this performance for his audience of one, oozing disdain and contempt for the committee. He refuses to answer questions, full obstruction on view. Act Two was very different. Act Two was sort of the exposure and meltdown, in part because rather than having the politicians do the questioning, they let an attorney, Barry Burke, interrogate Corey Lewandowski, and it didn't go well. So David, before we get into the Q&A here, let's just remind ourselves what happened. This is about a minute and a half of Barry Burke, I would say, dismantling Corey Lewandowski.
I was you saying on MSNBC, you don't ever remember the president ever asking you to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way, shape, or form. That wasn't true, was it, sir?
I heard that.
And that was not true, was it?
I have no obligation to be honest with the media just because they're just as dishonest as anybody else.
So you're admitting, sir, you were not being truthful in that clip, correct?
My interview with Ari Melberg?
Yes.
Can be interpreted any way you'd like.
Would you like me to play it again?
You're welcome to, please.
Play one more time.
I don't ever remember the president ever asking me to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice in any way,
okay,
shape, or form,
so,
ever.
And, sir, it is true in May 2019. You absolutely remembered when the president asked you to deliver a message to the attorney general of a speech for him to give related to the special counsel investigation. Isn't that correct?
I'd have to think about it.
Are you claiming, sir, that, and you had been interviewed by the special counsel about those very events in which you discussed and you said was accurately reported in the report a year earlier. Are you saying, sir, you may have forgotten it by the time you were interviewed just before the report was publicly released?
I'm saying my memory was clearly much fresher when I actually gave the interview with the special counsel's report.
Sir, is it your testimony before this committee that when you said you did not remember the president ever asking you to get involved with Jeff Sessions or the Department of Justice, you were saying you were being truthful? And, sir, I don't believe there's any reason to consult with your counsel. The question is, are you a truth teller in that interview?
I'm a truth teller every time I stand before Congress or a committee of jurisdiction and raise my hand and swear to God under oath.
My question, sir.
All right, so David, you really have Corey Lewandowski, acknowledging that, unless he's under oath, he lies. He lies all the time, which I think raises all sorts of questions about Corey Lewandowski and frankly, the media. Your take on what happened yesterday?
Yeah, fascinating, actually, that Corey Lewandowski, on the day he promoted his Senate run in the state of New Hampshire, announces to the world that he lies publicly to everybody. I mean, if you're a New Hampshire Republican, please take note that this candidate has told you he's going to lie to you when he's talking to the media. But from a legal standpoint, from the impeachment standpoint, thank goodness we had the questioning from the counsel at the end, because it did frame real clarity around the truth, the underlying foundational truth to these issues that are of grave constitutional consequence. You know, prior to the counsel's questioning, I still would have said, despite the circus and despite his ability to not answer questions and to be a bit of a showman in Trumpian context, this was one of those hearings where the written transcript, actually, still, even without the counsel's questioning, the written transcript is incredibly damning for Lewandowski and the president. If you extract the theatrics out of it, Corey Lewandowski confirmed for the record that, yes, Donald Trump instructed him to commit obstruction of justice. Now, rewind a few months. What Democrats said is we have to have these hearings and these witnesses to provide confirmation of the Mueller report, to put color on it. Corey Lewandowski did that. He said, Donald Trump instructed me to obstruct justice. He did that in answering, I believe it was Hank Johnson's questions, confirming the Mueller report. And then we get to the staff counsel's questions where Lewandowski is forced to say, yes, I've lied publicly about this, and yes, indeed, all of this is true. Democrats, we know that Republicans are going to continue to obfuscate and obstruct. It is now on you, and you have to grab this mantle to frame with clarity the truth of what happened for the American people. Lewandowski gave House Democrats what they needed for the first article of impeachment against Donald Trump, which was that he obstructed an aide, and he was not a government employee, but he is a senior aide, private citizen. Even worse, he instructed this person to conspire to obstruct justice. I think Democrats have what they need. They had it already, but if you needed more, you got it yesterday to file an article of impeachment against Donald Trump.
It was striking. It's worth reminding people that Corey Lewandowski never actually worked in the White House. He was never actually an executive branch employee. So when the White House instructs him not to cooperate, they're not invoking anything like the executive privilege that we've seen before. This really was a departure. But up until the moments you've described, I have to say the Democratic questioning and procedure looked quite shambolic. And people I know throughout the day were saying, what were the Democrats thinking? How did they expect this to go? Donald Trump was absolutely delighted by this, tweeting out, what a marvelous job Corey Lewandowski was doing. And it was really striking, though, with the exception of the questioning of Hank Johnson, which you just mentioned, that it really was only effective when the congressman finally shut up, and they let Barry Burke do the questioning. They should have led with Barry Burke, shouldn't they?
They should have. And listen, this is also on House members to do a better job at their job. Cynthia Oxney, who a lot of people may see as a legal contributor on MSNBC, she commented after the Mueller hearing, I'm not sure I would trust Democrats to be able to execute an impeachment inquiry at this point. And it was somewhat prescient, what she said there. There were moments that House Democrats were unprepared for with a witness who was determined to obstruct. And to your point, Charlie, not just the underlying obstruction of justice charge with the president instructing the firing of Bob Mueller and Jeff Sessions to lead the nation in a different direction, but the obstruction of this proceeding by Congress also could be a charge. Very importantly, in the nuance of congressional rules, Jerry Nadler, at the end of the hearing, did not close and adjourn the hearing. He left it open subject to the call of the chair. And the reason he did that, I believe, is because Corey Lewandowski did a couple things yesterday in admitting his lies, but even in answering questions different ways, he impugned his own words that he gave to Mueller and he gave to the committee. He showed an intent to lie to one of those two bodies. There are misstatements all over the place now, as I mentioned, that will be in the written transcript. He very well could begin to tighten the cuffs, if you will, around Lewandowski, because Lewandowski could find himself in legal jeopardy, either subject to a criminal referral to the Department of Justice or contempt of Congress here as this moves forward.
You know what I thought was interesting, though, was the fact. Yes, Corey Lewandowski turns out to be a liar. He's exposed as a liar, and we shouldn't really be surprised about this. In my newsletter this morning, I said, "Look, this is the essence of Trumpism," and it is. Well, and Harry Lippmann wrote in the Washington Post, pugnacious, contemptuous, indifferent to law or fact. Lewandowski is a perfect model for a sustained Trumpian legacy in U.S. political life. And, in Earth 2.0, we wouldn't be talking about Corey Lewandowski, because in Earth 2.0, which is more rational, he would never have gotten close to a serious campaign, much less in the orbit of the president of the United States. And yet we're being reminded again of what this administration represents. I mean, Trump has created this hive of liars around him, and he's one of the drones. So the nastiness, the obstruction, the deception isn't the glitch, it's the feature. So you mentioned, how's this going to play if running for Senate? And I guess the obvious question is, do Republicans actually care about this anymore? Isn't this sort of baked in now? If you're supporting Donald Trump for re-election, if you're still on board with that, then obviously the distinction between truth and lies is not a make or break issue for you, right?
Right. No, you're exactly right. And I would add to that commentary, it was a perfectly Trumpian moment. And what sealed it was actually, so there was the bombastic, the pomposity, the irreverence for the truth, the joking. And frankly, Republicans on the Judiciary Committee celebrated this irreverent smash mouth politics that with a total disregard for the office, the truth, the Constitution, if you will. But then the final Trumpian moment is when he actually gets called to account and is in the corner. What does he do? He blames somebody else. Well, that was Sam Clovis's fault, right? When he actually has to acknowledge the truth that, yes, the Russians did approach the campaign, and yes, the campaign did take the meetings. Well, Corey, why didn't you do something about it? Oh, well, that was somebody else's fault. It's a perfect Trumpian moment. But the graver part of this, and I think you alluded to it in your question, Charlie, is the fundamental irreverence now for both the institutions that have arguably kept our country together, as well as for the fundamental elements of truth, respect for process. You know, what we saw in the Nixon impeachment, despite all the political hijinks trying to avoid accountability by the Nixon administration, there finally came that moment where people recognize I'm under oath before the Congress and before the country, and I have a higher duty to country to tell the truth. I had a colleague tell me that about actually Bob Mueller's decisions when he testified. Bob Mueller decided he was going to take the role of kind of the CEO of the special counsel's office, say the report spoke for itself, and not engage in further questioning or explanation. This colleague said to me, Mueller missed the moment where he had a higher duty to the nation to say, this is what I really believe happened and what the nation should be most concerned about, not just about Russian interference, but about the president's obstruction. Instead, Mueller didn't meet that moment. What we saw yesterday in Lewandowski is a perfect reflection of Trumpian that they don't even care to try. That hurts us all, regardless of party, to know that there is a major party within the United States that's willing to cast aside any conviction of a higher calling or duty to country. Instead, it is about this Trump cult that they have pledged their allegiance to.
And that's going to have long-term damage. So just going back to, that's a hard act to follow, by the way, David, but going back to the Corey Lewandowski issue, and there was a lot of people you could see in Trump world who were really applauding his statement. He says, I have no obligation to be honest with the media. And we have a piece up at the Bulwark by Jonathan Last, who's, you know, said, you know, here's 33 questions. Like, you know, so under what circumstances are you obligated to be honest? Are you obligated to be honest when speaking to the public? Were you honest when you were a paid contributor to CNN and One America News Network now, and questions to the media, including CNN? Why are you having this guy back on? He's basically saying that he's prepared to lie. I mean, they hired him to be a contributing analyst. And so for the rest of the media, I think, are you ever going to book Lewandowski again? Or are you going to ask this question of other folks in the media? Okay, so I want to shift to some new polls. Let's talk about the presidential race. And there's a big NBC poll out today showing Joe Biden picking up some steam, Elizabeth Warren picking up some steam, and lots and lots and lots of losers. And I want to talk about the state of play. And I think that you and I may disagree about this. So let's talk about this right after this word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, B-U-L-W-A-R-K, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, I'm back with former Congressman Dave Jolly. The new NBC poll shows once again that Joe Biden is sticking around. He's still in first place. Elizabeth Warren is in second place, solid second place. She's also picking up. Kamala Harris dropping 8 points. She's now down to about 5 percentage points. I mean, she is barely ahead of Andrew Yang. And Julian Castro, after his kamikaze attack on Joe Biden, he soared up to, well, he didn't actually move, he's at 1%. And then of course, you have Beto O'Rourke, who threw the Hail Mary pass on guns, and he went from 2% to 1%. But there's a lot of speculation now that even though Joe Biden is hanging in there and has survived the gaffes, has survived the pile-on from the media and his critics on the left, including bizarrely's calls for him to drop out, that despite all of that, that Elizabeth Warren is the candidate with the momentum. So let's talk about Elizabeth Warren and the questions about whether or not she's electable.
I am the contrarian among certainly Republicans, but even former Republicans or never Trump Republicans who say the Democrats can't go that progressive. I actually think Elizabeth Warren can win this primary and can win the entire thing next November. And it may even be a prediction on my part, not an endorsement, but it may be a prediction. I'm not endorsing through November of 2020 for reasons of maintaining my independence on TV. But I think Elizabeth Warren can win it all. And the reason why, Charlie, is in the Democratic primary, she has that intangible that every candidate wants. It's not just the momentum, it's the energy, it's the passion, it's the conviction. She can handle any moment, any question. She's smart on policy. She's nearly brilliant on politics. And Joe Biden is Uncle Joe, right? He's the contrast to that, that people are comfortable with, that they look to for that senior leadership. In many ways, this is emerging almost as a two-person race as we go into the fall. I think it will be on the eve of Iowa, New Hampshire. We still will be talking about a Biden-Warren contest, if you will. But here's why I think Warren makes such a great candidate next November if Democrats choose to nominate her. She is the perfect contrast with Donald Trump in two areas. One, she matches the boldness of his leadership. Look, Donald Trump, for whatever you disagree with him on, in his brashness, there is a bold form of leadership, a person who's willing to just wreck everything, a politician we haven't seen before. And Warren, there's equally a boldness when it comes to ideology, the willingness to talk about Medicare for All, something that really would not pull well, but she's willing to talk about it. What has been a history of a progressive agenda for Elizabeth Warren that maybe just one or two steps out of the mainstream when it comes to general elections, she's willing to go to the mat out of a spirit of boldness. The second contrasting area, though, that I think is very important, Elizabeth Warren is happy. She's a happy warrior. Donald Trump is an angry populist. Elizabeth Warren is saying, you know what, Donald Trump? You've chosen to be an angry populist, and actually when people aren't looking, you hand out all the favors to the rich. I'm the happy warrior who says, I'm going to fight for the person on Main Street, and there's no going to be handing out favors to the rich. I'm going to try to equalize this economy where we know the disparity of economic growth is continuing to expand, but she's happy. And I got to tell you, Charlie, I wouldn't have guessed this 5 years ago that I would be describing Elizabeth Warren as the happy warrior. Republicans did everything they could to make her kind of the angry boogeyman in politics or boogeywoman in politics. She has emerged, though, as this very passionate warrior. And I think this might be her time.
Well, OK, so you may be right, but I'm not seeing it. Yes, she's clearly smart and she's got the policy chops. I'm not sure that policy actually wins these elections. And I guess the question comes down to whether or not voters Really, you know, what do they want? They want this to be a referendum on Donald Trump, or they want it to be a referendum on a sharp shift to the left, whether they want a return to normalcy or more revolution. And I guess in her personality, I can't get past that sense that she's kind of like the high school vice principal. Not to mention the fact that she's taken, you've run in these races and you know how these positions can be weaponized. You know, she, the position that she has taken on, on Medicare for all, and abolishing private insurance is not just a bold idea. It's an extreme and unpopular idea. When people are, you know, when people learn that, and they will learn because the Republicans will spend $1 billion telling them that she's going to take away their private insurance, that's not a positive. She's right. been dodging and hedging on the question of who's going to pay for all these ideas, whether it's going to will mean a middle class tax cut. Bernie Sanders is very much upfront about it, and her position on immigration certainly sounds suspiciously like open borders. So my concern is that she walks into many of the caricatures that Republicans will love to paint of any Democrat, but in her case, she'll have this paper trail. And I guess I'm not sure that she is. I mean, her campaign right now is very much focused on the primary. It's not focused on a general election. She had the big crowds, but getting big crowds in Greenwich Village does not mean you're going to win the Electoral College. And I'm just not sure how she matches up with Donald Trump in those states, like, well, for example, you know, Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, where the election is going to be decided.
Sure. And look, in terms of defining progressive politics right now, probably the singular issue that provides the contrast and the definition around progressive politics is this issue of Medicare for all. And it is an area where, setting aside policy for a moment, that, you know, we could have a wonky debate over healthcare policy, but just the raw politics of it, the challenge for somebody who is promoting Medicare for all is they're saying to voters, you must, right? You have to. You will do this. Compared to candidates like Mayor Pete, Biden, others who are promoting a public option, they're saying to voters, you may. If you'd like to do this, you may. You may enroll in a public option. And honestly, for all of the suggestions, Charlie, that somehow we have free market healthcare now, we don't. Even Republicans have destroyed the free market principles around healthcare. And so I think we are in a moment of time where a public option is something that the American people would say, yeah, let's see how this goes. If whoever the nominee is, if it's Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, whoever it may be that otherwise would be promoting Medicare for all, could find a way to say, you know what, it's too soon for you must. Let's talk about you may. That would be a different political narrative, and one that I think would be more better received.
Well, I agree. And I think that you're already seeing that playing out on the debate. I mean, that's what Amy Klobuchar is talking about. Mayor Pete is talking about. I think Joe Biden is talking about as well. I guess the question is whether or not Elizabeth, and you know, her the polling and her own electoral track record would suggest that she does very well among Democratic elites. She does much less well among working class, lower middle class voters, African American voters. In other words, the voters that will decide this election. So I am not convinced that she can go all the way. And I'm not convinced that Democrats are really prepared to make that shift to the left. But then, of course, you know, look, I've been wrong about pretty much everything for a very, very long time.
Yeah, me too. We always get prognosticated wrong, right? The one thing I'd add, Charlie, though, to the politics of it is Republicans are going to paint whoever the nominee is as a socialist. And I believe Trump is going to try to establish and inject elements of criminality around the individual, right? If it's Biden, it'll be the Ukraine. If it's Warren, it'll be she cheated on applications. It's going to be the Hillary 2.0 playbook. And even if you chose, say, Tim Ryan, not even Joe Biden, what the Republicans are going to do is he's the nominee of the party of socialism. He's the nominee of the party of Medicare for all. So that brand is coming on to whoever the nominee is regardless, which is why I make the point to Democrats, just have the family conversation and choose who you want your nominee to be, whether it's progressive or moderate. I don't think the electoral equation changes in a general election. But as you said, pundits are often wrong. I know I am.
See, I see this differently. Yes, they will make those charges. You're absolutely right. But it's the difference between saying, yes, damn right, I am a socialist. Yes, I am going to take away your guns. Yes, we are going to open the borders. And yes, we are going to, abolish your private health care. There is a difference between that and going, well, there you go again. This is Donald Trump, who has, been a serial liar, and he's lying again about what we are doing. Here's the real story. I can see Joe Biden pulling that off. And by the way, let's talk about Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden is just being hammered, every single gaffe, every single, weird Uncle Joe story. And yet his numbers are not moving down. This guy is showing, he's showing more durability. And I really get the sense that the media is adopting this narrative about him and about Elizabeth Warren that is disconnected from what's actually happening. And the durability of his support is really one of the biggest stories, I think, of the year, including the way that African Americans are just hanging with this guy.
So you're exactly right, Charlie. His numbers aren't really softening. It's that Elizabeth Warren is taking from all the other candidates and hers are building. And this may very well come down to an organization ground game in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada. These elections, these primaries and caucuses, are going to be decided by a very small group of people in these states, and the campaigns really do have to organize around them. My take on the Joe Biden storylines, and I agree with you to the extent of the media's responsibility that we have to contextualize some of the call them gaffes or these moments that Biden is having. It is not the same as Donald Trump. Donald Trump lies, manipulates, obfuscates, intentionally tries to mislead people. With Joe Biden, I would say they truly are gaffes, but where you see moments where these gaffes do implicate policy, and this really is a Democratic family conversation, I don't have a seat at the table, but I hope we see the Democrats have this conversation, are in conversations around race and culture. And I think Biden could lead this part of the conversation, which is this. Do we contextualize someone's leadership around issues of race and culture in the time in which they served? Right? When Joe Biden made leadership decisions in the 70s and 80s and 90s around race and culture, do we contextualize them around the era in which he was making those decisions? Or are we contextualizing them around 2019 with where the Democrats and frankly, fortunately, our culture has moved to a place where we talk differently around race and culture and have even greater expectations than we had. Biden can make the case he was a civil rights leader throughout his career, but you do hear progressives in 2019 saying, wait a minute, Mr. Biden, your record player comment actually shows how out of touch you are with contemporary conversation around race and culture. That is an important conversation to have. And on the raw gaffes, I do think we have to continue to present them and let voters decide if it's an important issue for them or not. We are talking about somebody who's asking to be the next president of the United States, and where the media may have missed questions of fitness on Donald Trump that were raw and should have been covered. I think for all the candidates, Joe Biden or Julian Castro, if there are moments where they show either a lapse of temperament or a lapse of recall, they have to be presented to voters and let voters decide if those moments are important.
No, I agree with all of that. And I think that in fact, will happen. We also have to comment on the other major story. I mean, I said that obviously the rise of Elizabeth Warren, the persistence of Joe Biden. But the name we haven't mentioned is Bernie Sanders. And this week, I think it's become more and more apparent that if there is the internal pre-primary on the progressive lane, that Elizabeth Warren is really starting to lap Bernie Sanders. And it's interesting that we haven't had this debate or this discussion about Bernie Sanders being too old, when in fact he's even older and I would say shakier in many ways than Joe Biden. But I think it's a recognition that, well, he's not the front runner and he's not going to be the front runner. And in fact, the progressive world seems to be coalescing around Elizabeth Warren, because he's just, I think his time, you know, was there and it has passed. And I think this Working Families endorsement, which again, I'm not going to claim that that I understand all of the maneuvering among the various, you know, Menshevik, Bolsheviks, whatever over there. But that seemed to be a significant development. Okay, before we move on, though, thoughts about the Republican race. There are, in fact, you know, three challengers. You have Bill Weld, you have Joe Walsh, and you have Mark Sanford. And you have this movement among Republicans in a number of states to abolish the primaries and the caucuses because they don't think the voters need to actually vote, that they want the nomination process to be a coronation. Now, I know this has happened before, but this really strikes me as really extraordinary that if the Trumpians are that confident that he's got 90% support, why are they so afraid of actually having a primary election?
Well, that's it. And it's fundamentally anti-democratic, but even politically, if you're going to put up a primary wins at 90%, you want that story because that just reinforces that you do have a tight hold on the party. I think the president is more vulnerable than people are leading on. I mean, we see polls where, you know, 20-30% wish that there was another Republican in place. Now, would you really see that in primary elections? Probably not, but there could be the one-off. I thought for a while if it was a two-person Republican primary, particularly in the state of New Hampshire, where New Hampshire Republicans have a bit more independence than other states, that Donald Trump could face a challenge like Bush 41 faced from Buchanan. You could see a challenger take the shine off of Donald Trump in Republican politics in some of the early primaries. But now with three challengers, I think it's a little less likely. The most compelling challenger to Donald Trump is Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford brings the conservative credentials that go all the way back to the 1994 Republican Revolution when he was first elected to Congress, a down-the-line conservative on economics and on taxes and fiscal issues, somebody who at his inauguration for to be governor of South Carolina was immediately considered a potential presidential nominee. He is incredibly smart. He can challenge the president as not being a conservative, which is dogma within the Republican Party, right? Or at least it used to be. But here's the other personal narrative. We all know the personal failings of Mark Sanford. He has opened up about them. And within this party, within this moment, in this election, Mark Sanford actually can speak to his personal failings, and he has said this to me privately, and I've now heard him say it publicly. He said, you know what? When I had my personal failings, I had to face account for those failings with voters and with people in my party. I had to face the consequences of them. And Mark will tell you that politicians should face the consequences of their failings in public life. Mark will also tell you that he took for granted what it meant to hold the public trust and to serve. And so when he reemerged in 2014 in a special election, when Tim Scott moved over to the Senate, he lost the support of the NRCC over his personal failings. He took his message directly to voters and said, I stand for these conservative principles. I'm going to fight for you. And I acknowledge and I apologize and I own up to my personal failings. Everything about Mark Sanford is the pure Republican contrast to this man in the White House and Donald Trump, who is trying to cancel primaries, who is not a conservative, who laughs at his own personal failings and pretends they don't even matter to the country, to the party, or to people who look to the presidency with an expectation of decency and morality. I would love to see a two-person race between Mark Sanford and Donald Trump.
That's fascinating because I would have said that Mark Sanford was the weakest of the three, but you make a very, very compelling case. I guess going back to this question of the vulnerability of Donald Trump, the fact is that you have three candidates. None of them are going to beat Donald Trump, but they are of different flavors, so that if you do have voters that want to cast a protest vote against Donald Trump. There's not just one alternative. There's one. There's three. If you want somebody who's, you know, hard right, you go with Joe Walsh. Joe Walsh is, you know, to the right of the president on a lot of issues. You know, if you care about fiscal conservatism and the issues you just described, you go with Mark Sanford. And Bill Weld is a known quantity, a grown up in this particular race. So the number to watch is not which of the number, the percentage that each one of those will get. It's that can cumulatively, could they put together, you know, in the high 20s or into the 30s or even above in a state like New Hampshire? And I think the multiplicity of candidates might actually work in a different way than the one-on-one, because it means that if you go into that voting booth and you just want to send a message to Donald Trump, or you want to, you know, you want to record your dissent, you have more ways of doing it. I would have a hard time voting for Joe Walsh. I would have much less hard time voting for a Mark Sanford or a Bill Weld. So we'll see how that plays out. But it is extraordinary when you talk about the attack on democracy. I mean, literally, when you canceled the primary, that is an attack on the democratic process. It is literally basically saying we're canceling the vote. Okay, one other thing in the time that we have left. I don't know whether you caught this yesterday. There was a media forum where they were talking about media bias. And this is the day that we learn that ABC legend Cokie Roberts had passed away. And I want to mention that when I was doing my radio show many, many years ago in a different life, every Friday morning, because we were the ABC News affiliate, they made Cokie Roberts available. And so she was on my program. And I always found her to be gracious and informed and insightful, even when we disagreed. I mean, we had interesting conversations. And I always thought of her as representing just this fundamental class act. And so I think that she deserves a lot of the praise that she's getting. But yesterday there is this forum, and Brian Stelter from CNN is the MC. And on this panel talking about the media is Michelle Malkin, you know, a longtime conservative commentator, author. She's peddling a book about open borders and everything. And this is how she chose to address this issue. Just let's play this soundbite.
President Trump did not invent the concept of fake news. Cokie Roberts, of course, passed away today, and God bless her for an incredible career that she had. But I distinctly remember that she was one of the first guilty culprits of fake news. In 1994...
Wait, are we doing this today?
Yes.
We're doing this today.
Yes, we are.
You're attacking her today.
I just want
to be clear. The body's not cold yet.
So there we go. Okay, do you want to hear what I have to say? Because it is
I'm just curious.
It is today. Because it's pertinent to a discussion about fake news and media bias.
Now, you know, David, I don't know what else to say other than this, but, you know, it's certainly a marker of the decline of civility and decency in our politics that there's not this moment to say, you know what, we're not going to take the occasion of someone's death to score political points. But this now also seems to be more and more routine.
That's true. And look, culturally, we may never change the hearts and minds and decency or indecency of people like Michelle in that moment. But I do think what has changed in this era in which we're living is we have leaders in politics and industry that give permission for moments like that. And good for Brian Stelter for trying to push back on that. He showed leadership within the industry of media to say, wait a minute, is that really appropriate to talk about? But we know in politics, look, we spent the last three worlds witnessing how Donald Trump has given permission to elements that at times are racist or misogynist, but at all times are irreverent and allow the type of insulting moments like we saw from Michelle yesterday. But it's not just Donald Trump in the White House. We started the show talking about Corinne Lewandowski's irreverence and insults yesterday at the hearing, and you could hear Republican members of Congress on the Judiciary Committee laugh at them or even bait him to go further. That to me is a moment of a compelling moment that demands more of our leaders in politics and in industry, because it is the permission that they have given that has allowed these moments within our culture to emerge. And, you know, it sounds silly to always say elections matter, but we need to change the leadership in the White House. And if there are media outlets that allow this type of talk, we need to change the channel. And we need to demand that people like Corin Lewandowski, who say, yes, I lie to the media, don't have a place or a platform going forward in mainstream society. That is something we can do.
Yeah, we can. And I have to say, though, that this is not just a phenomenon on the right. This has become part of social media. I recall when prominent conservatives have died, there have been people who have celebrated their death in the crudest possible way. I remember when Andrew Breitbart died, and I had many, many differences, obviously. I mean, you know, I think his name has been sullied by the people who continue to run the website in his name, but I disagreed with things he did. But I remember that when he died suddenly, which was a tragedy for his family, that we had a talk show host in Wisconsin who talked about, you know, going and pissing on his grave, pouring Roundup on his grave, saying, I'm glad he's dead. And I think this is the moment where clearly we no longer deal with each other as human beings. I mean, the ultimate definition of civility would be that you and I can disagree, perhaps even vigorously, on many issues facing society, but also ultimately recognize that we are human beings and that transcends our political differences. That I think we're losing. So I think that when we talk about the tribalism and the polarization, somehow that's a euphemism for the erasure of our human identity, because it's more important for us to score this particular point. And the thing about Michelle Malkin, she's always been a zealot, but it was, you know, is there some part of her in her head that thought maybe this is not the right moment to use Cokie Roberts as the example of what I am attacking? Because, I mean, were we always like this, or are we gotten worse? I don't know. Okay, the most important story, the most important question we've been building up. I wanted to give you practice in expressing opinions, but the question of the Princess Bride. There is talk of remaking the movie. There are people who think, why would you take something that was absolutely perfect and remake it? I mean, this is one of, I think, the cultural markers of our time. Where do you come down, David Jolly, on remaking The Princess Bride?
I would love to see it, and it will not impugn the purity of the initial take. You know, look, when they redid All in the Family and The Jeffersons this summer, which I would encourage everybody, go watch. It's incredibly culturally relevant for where we are. The same questions emerged, but they pulled it off. Here's my Princess Bride comment for where we are politically right now. And it's this: to any Republican who ever thinks you're going to take on AOC in a Twitter war, think about that moment in Princess Bride where they're playing chess on the cliff and they're deciding which drink is poisoned, right? And the guy says, you fool, the two things to never forget: don't get in a land war in Asia and don't challenge a Sicilian in a poison contest. I want to say that to every Republican who takes on AOC, you fool. I don't know what the other rule is, but the second one is don't take on AOC in a Twitter war because you're going to lose.
Okay.
That's my Princess Bride moment for you.
Extra points for actually quoting from the movie, but a really seriously wrong opinion, Mr. Jolly, on whether it should be remade. It cannot be remade.
You don't want it done.
Come on, could we just leave something good and unsullied? Because because the fact is, see, you just demonstrated that you can apply it on a daily basis, just off the top of your head, and it is one of those perfect gems, and we can't do it. So you are not only wrong about this. I do think that you actually need to like delete your account now. Having said that,
all right. Hey Charlie, I will take your advice on this. I trust your judgment. Next time somebody asks, I'll say no. Charlie said no, and I agree.
That's just the correct opinion. It's not because I said it. Hey, David Jolly, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Always a pleasure to have you.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you by ZipRecruiter. And I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.